This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At home, I use a Chemex. At work, I use an AeroPress. I like a medium to fine grind, and I prefer bold flavor with hints of chocolate, caramel, leather, and cherry. Though sometimes I don't mind dipping into the peachy pineapple more bright range. And I'm a Luddite. I often add cream. Okay, those who feel the same are probably nodding now along with the radio, and those not in the know are baffled, and those who know but don't care are rolling their eyes and thinking, snob. I'm talking about coffee, and it is a great time to be a coffee snob in Vermont and around the country for that matter, though I'm not sure our guests today would appreciate being called snobs. Good coffee is, in fact, more and more accessible. And no matter what kind of coffee you like and how you take it, and however deep into sourcing and brewing methods you want to go, you can find a place, probably pretty nearby, to satisfy your deepest caffeinated desires. We're going to dip into the coffee world today, and we'd love to know where or how you take your Joe. Post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Brown & Jenkins is a coffee roasting company in Jeffersonville that's been around since 1984. You won't find their coffee at your local supermarket. They roast every other day and ship to customers across the country. VPR's Rick Sangari got a peek at the roasting process from Rich Williams, who owns Brown & Jenkins with his wife, Sandy Riggin.
Right now, I'm filling the bucket with 20 pounds of green beans. We're still waiting for the machine to warm up to 3 to 350 in temperature. Now I'm going to dump it in the top of the hopper on top of the machine. It'll set there. We've dumped it down in, and the hopper is roasting now. It'll take about 15 minutes for it to cook. At that point, we'll cool it, just dump it out, cool it off. During this process, we're taking small bits out and just testing it to see where the coffee is to make sure when it's ready to come out. We're looking for color. The color is what makes the difference in whether it's roasted properly or not. Now I'm dumping the coffee into the cooling bin. It'll go around the cooling bin for about 10 minutes to cool off. And meanwhile, it's just spinning around in circles and pulling cold air over the top to bring it down to temperature. We roast it to order. It's in a roaster today. We bag it and put it in a box and ship it to you. And normally it's within a week, 5 to 6 days, you have your coffee on your doorstep and it's fresh. It's not vacuum packed or anything else. It's just fresh right from the machine to your house. And now we're dumping all the coffee into the coffee bin that we're going to take the coffee out of to put in the bags. Next thing we're going to do is take it over and grind it. We're grinding the coffee now. One of our most popular flavors is the Mountain Magic, or in the wintertime it's called Jingle Bell Java. It is a caramel, cinnamon, vanilla, and pecan and rum flavors in it. It's one of our biggest sellers. We had to change the name because in the summertime, nobody wanted to buy the Jingle Bell Java. We couldn't give a bag away. So my wife came up with Mountain Magic, and people have it all the time now. So
that's Rich Williams, co-owner of Brown & Jenkins in Jeffersonville. Now, to carry on this coffee conversation, I'm joined by Dan Cox, owner and president of Coffee Enterprises. That's a coffee consulting business well known around the state and beyond. And Dan comes by his coffee expertise through many, many years in the business, including rising through the ranks at what used to be known as Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, now Keurig Green Mountain, where he says he was the first full-time employee. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Greetings, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You know, it seems like a really good time to be a coffee drinker, but I am conscious that perhaps that's because, you know, I'm feeling this coffee renaissance and learning more about it, and maybe every generation of coffee aficionados comes to this idea afresh. But is it actually something new under the sun right now, this renaissance of coffee and small artisan coffee makers?
Yes and no. At the turn of the 20th century, just about every small town in the United States had a small coffee roasting company, very much like bakeries. And then with the advent of canned coffee and supermarket chains and mass distribution, they fell away. In the 80s, it came about where people could all of a sudden start to tell the difference with something as simple as Colombian coffee. A fresh Colombian coffee had so much more flavor than a canned coffee that had a combination of Arabica and Robusta. So that was the kickoff. And then we had some great regional roasters. Of course, my old stomping grounds, Green Mountain, did a great job. But within New England, there were maybe five or six really good regional roasters. And they started branching off and using some coffee, Senegal country of origin coffees that people said, geez, where is that? Where's Guatemala? Where's El Salvador? Where's Cameroon? And it just piqued their interest. And this was also at the same time wines were becoming more to the forefront. People were spending a little bit more on wine. So it was better in the 21st century, the beginning, and now it's coming back. And I'm always surprised at these towns that have coffee roasters now. I go around Vermont and I'm going, my gosh, is there a business here or are these people just loving coffee?
But it's not just Vermont, right? I mean, is this happening? It seems like it's happening everywhere I go in various parts around the country.
Well, a good example would be the Specialty Coffee Association of America. I was president of that for 3 years, and we had like 40 members when I started it. And when I left, we had like 200 members. Today, there are like 8,000 members, of which probably 2,000 of them are coffee roasting companies. So people have certainly got the bug that, one, this product can taste really good. Number two, there are some incredible new health studies out that coffee is actually more than just the up in the cup with the caffeine, that it's got some real benefits to it. And it's like each day, more and more scientific studies are coming out saying, hey, if you have a drink of choice for a pure health benefit, drink coffee. I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but I will say drink coffee because you like it, and it tastes good, and it gives you some up in the cup. The health benefits are an added plus.
Although, yeah, I mean, anybody who comes from the coffee industry talking about the health benefits, you sort of have a reason to look at the studies that show the benefits and maybe happen to not see any of the ones that show the downsides.
Well, I would just say talk to my wife because I come home and show these studies to her and she goes, yeah, right, that's your industry trying to pump it up. And I go, no, dear, not necessarily.
How would you characterize the coffee culture in Vermont right now?
Very strong. I'm actually a little worried, a little skeptical, because I look at it's one thing to have passion for a product, but you have to have a business plan. And you have to, at the end of the day, you can't take your passion to the bank. And so if you're going to get into the coffee business now, number one, it's a premature industry. Number two, you have to have a point of differentiation. So if your point of differentiation is nothing more than, hey, I'm the only guy in town, that's a good point. But if you're in some of these small towns with a basis of between, say, 5,000 and 8,000 or 10,000 people, it's going to be very hard. I mean, it's one thing to own a business and make a livelihood. It's another thing and work 70 hours a week. And it's another thing to actually expand from that, have employees, be able to take some time off, give health benefits, et cetera. So my concern is it's great that they're popping up, but just make sure that you have some good business sense.
We've been hearing since we said we were going to do this show from a lot of coffee roasters and cafes around the state. I'll read a few of the notes we've gotten. Tyler Van Loo, quality manager and coffee educator at Brio Coffee Works in Burlington, says, drink coffee, drink often. Scott Wigland, owner and roaster of Brave Coffee and Tea in Waterbury, says, don't forget to mention the smaller roasters in Vermont. Brave Coffee and Tea, Carrier, Brio, Earthback, Upper Valley Coffee, and many more I'm probably forgetting. It's a great time to get good coffee in Vermont. Eric Svensson, director of Coffee Partners, emailed, we're a coffee quality assurance laboratory, coffee and consulting company in White River Junction. We work with organizations at all stages of the coffee supply chains, from small family farms in origin to large multinationals. We perform the certification of green coffee and QA testing of finished roasting products for Dunkin' Donuts and other companies. And we do testing on coffee in all forms, conduct shelf life testing, and blend and roast profile R&D for companies. We also got a note from Kevin Clayton, owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne, who says, people tell me all the time that the coffee they make at home doesn't taste as good as when they get it fresh from the shop, and he has tips for them that I will pass along a couple of to you, although he does say, it is nice to see them at the shop, though. But Kevin says, the first thing I ask them is, what does their water at home taste like? Then find a water they like the flavor of. Many brands of bottled water, and yes, the flavors vary. Kevin says, buy fresh roasted whole bean coffee from a local roaster that not only knows what they're doing but is selling lots of coffee. Spend the money on a good grinder and only grind the amount you need right before you make the coffee, as fresh ground coffee starts to lose some of its flavor within 15 minutes of grinding it. You know, Dan, what interests me about these notes and what I've seen in some of the coffee producers in the state, some of the roasters, is that it seems like a collegial atmosphere. It doesn't seem like hard-nosed competition, even though these people are all trying to occupy, in some ways, the same niche. Does it seem like an industry that people get along well in?
It's extremely collaborative, and in the early days, it was even more so. We all help each other out. And if you're out of something or if you need to go someplace to get some more information, for some reason, there's a passion there. And it also goes all the way down to, if you're going to be in the coffee business, at some point you're going to want to go to coffee source. You're going to want to go to where it's produced. This is very unusual. I don't know of another product, wine to a degree, that people feel compelled. They want to go to the farms, meet the producers, see how it's processed, and follow the chain of custody from the tree all the way to the cup. Once they do that, there's no turning back. They've seen the light. They've seen what's behind the curtain, and they say, now, one, we know what it's like. Number two, we usually have to give – we want to give back to the producer because it's so difficult to grow coffee, and it's so labor-intensive. And, of course, the producers think we're making all the money. And in some ways, they're right. Certainly, the cost, the price of coffee fluctuates all the time, and it's not necessarily equated to the quality of the coffee. But, yeah, it's going back to your question, it's incredibly collegial. Most of the companies you just mentioned, I know personally. I know the owners. And they can call me. I can call them if I've got a question or if they need some answers. Yes, we don't charge each other. We just say, hey, welcome to the club of good coffee.
We're talking coffee today. And listeners, I'd love to know where you come into this conversation. Are you somebody who pours over books and looks at the flavor wheel and sips your coffee black and a little bit cool so you can bring out all of those flavors and differentiate? Or are you just somebody who says, look, just give me a cup of coffee. As long as it tastes like coffee, I'm happy. And speaking of how people differentiate themselves, let's go to Brattleboro for a few minutes and talk now with Jackie Billings, coffee consultant at Mocha Joe's Coffee Roasting Company. Hi, Jackie. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what characterizes the Mocha Joe flavor or the Mocha Joe coffee when we talk about, you know, different places having to differentiate themselves? How would you characterize Mocha Joe's?
Sure. Well, you know, we always have a lot of irons in the fire here, but probably the most exciting things that we have going on right now are the direct relationships that we are building with coffee growers at origin. Just like Dan was saying, our flagship program is an organic growers group in Cameroon, which we undertook in 2009 with the goal of developing specialty coffee in that region. We've been working with growers there on quality improvement, capacity building, and organic farming practices, as well as providing a market for the coffees that they produce, and we're seeing some really awesome results.
When you say awesome results, like what?
So Cameroon is the only country in West Africa that has the environmental conditions to produce really high-quality coffee. So when we began working there in 2009, they were simply mostly producing coffee for the commercial market. And now we're seeing some really fabulous, well-developed flavors there. The coffees are extraordinarily well-balanced. They're sweet with good body and a sort of a light structured acidity and flavors like mango and pineapple. So we're really enjoying the coffees that we are getting from there.
I understand actually one of the founders of Mocha Joe's, Pierre Cappy, is actually in Cameroon right now doing that work.
Yes, that's why he's not on the phone with you today.
So what is it? What does it mean to actually have that relationship with the producer? How does somebody who's then coming in for a cup of coffee or buying the beans experience that relationship?
Yeah, well, you know, it's you know, as most people know, the farmers that grow the coffee that we work with, they often live in extreme poverty, and coffee changes many hands before coming to the consumer, with sort of each middleman taking their cut along the way. And so by building these business partnerships directly with farmers, we can return more money to them, the pickers, the sorters, and really sort of create a global community kind of, you know, we've got a connection that's formed between our community here in Brattleboro and our community in Cameroon through this coffee that we've developed together, and that we're all really proud of.
That is Jackie Billings, coffee consultant at Mocha Joe's Coffee Roasting Company in Brattleboro. Jackie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We're talking coffee today, and we got a note speaking of the environmental conditions and what is happening in coffee. We got a note from Ani in Lindenville, who says coffee has been an enormous driver of rainforest deforestation, that is, wildlife extinction, and displacer of innocent indigenous tribes that once lived and depended on primary tropical forests that are now replaced and being replaced by coffee plantations. This is all driven by the American coffee consumer and other coffee drinkers throughout the world, and all for a substance that is nutritionally unnecessary at best. And Ani really doesn't like even the idea of doing this show. Dan, I would be curious what you think of what Ani's saying here and the problems that coffee can create and this desire for it.
Well, the first thing I want to say to Ani is give me the facts and the data. I've been to 22 different coffee-producing countries. Yes, I've seen wholesale planting, especially down in Brazil. But coffee trees do give off oxygen, and there's a lot of them. So we have to talk about what kind of deforestation she's talking about. There is no doubt in my mind that some indigenous tribes have been driven out of their natural habitats, natural areas. But I also see the thriving business of which would I rather grow, an agricultural product like coffee, or would I rather have beef grown? And you want to talk of devastation, you can talk about the cattle industry. So I think I respect what she's saying, but I think she's wrong.
Well, I think, I mean, some of the criticism, though, also comes from this idea of a single source or single product. And we got a note from Thana, who says, the places where coffee we drink is grown is in parts of the world where many of the birds that spend their summers in Vermont spend their winters. Many of the smaller farms with shade-grown coffee have been cleared for larger single-plant habitats, which are not good for the birds. The Blackburnian warblers we have in Vermont in the warmer seasons are just one example of a bird that can directly benefit from us being conscious of the source of our coffee beans. And Dan, I know that there are, you know, coffee roasters that are trying to be conscious of having bird-friendly habitat. You can see that logo actually on bags of beans now. So do you think there is an awareness in the industry of being better environmental stewards?
I get a little nervous or a little skeptical because I always want to see the data, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of data on this. All certified coffee, so whether it's Rainforest Alliance, Bird Friendly, Audubon, Fair Trade, Direct Trade, etc., all have issues, and you need to get into the details. So the first thing you have to look at on any of these coffees is, what does the stuff taste like? Because if it doesn't taste good, I don't care how bird-friendly, how Rainforest Alliance certified, how Fair Trade is, people aren't going to buy it the second time. So yes, I get it. I'm kind of not a closet environmentalist, but I certainly am very pro-environmentalist. But my first thing is, any coffee country that has a monoculture of one product is in trouble. And certainly organizations like Food for Farmers that go out and try to teach somebody, listen, coffee's great, but it's usually seasonal. What are you going to do between the seasons? And our job is to help you learn of another crop that can bring in money throughout the year. So I've been in plenty of plantations where I get nervous because the only thing I see is coffee. So I want to see vegetables. I want to see fruit. I want to see stuff that you can grow and you can eat yourself between the harvests. Now, if you wanted to go into honey and sell it, that's great too. So Bill Mayers is a product of teaching people how to grow honey down in some of these countries. Fantastic. Rick Pizer's, the whole thing that Rick's doing, and the same thing with sustainability, unbelievable. So our culture here, it's amazing. In little old Vermont, we have like 6 or 7 really world-class coffee people that are taking the message outside of Vermont to producing countries. And I think it's part of our culture of wanting to share, wanting to help the environment, and wanting to do better. Coffee is one of the issues.
More on coffee to come as we have a conversation about Vermont's coffee culture and some of the trends that you can see around Vermont and beyond. Share your two cents on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Hey, podcast listeners. This month, we're asking you to help us spread the word about great podcasts. So think of someone in your life and tell them about a podcast you think they'll love. If they don't know how to listen to podcasts, offer to show them. And then tell us what show you recommended, because we want new podcasts too. You can use the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. I know, very clever. And thanks for spreading the word. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. The art of creating an espresso-based drink is a point of pride for professional baristas. We asked one to take us through the process.
My name's Mike, and we're at Scout & Co. in Winooski.
We're making a cappuccino today. Classic cappuccino is about a third espresso, two-thirds milk. We grind our beans fresh into what's called a portafilter basket here. We tamp it down real tight so that we get nice, even extraction out of it. We like to pull our espresso somewhere between 20 and 30 seconds, get about 2 ounces of liquid in there. And then we want to froth our milk so that it expands about a third. So you're going to get like a third of foam and like two-thirds of milk underneath it. So it gives it a nice, velvety texture, super drinkable, and just really nice. One of my favorite things here.
That's Mike Jacob, barista at Scout in Winooski, serving up a cappuccino with a perfectly formed leaf in the foam. And we're talking coffee today with Dan Cox, who runs a coffee consulting and analysis company called Coffee Enterprises. We're getting your hot takes or cold takes on the best coffee and the best way to brew it as well. You can share yours on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Steve in Reading emailed in with his method. He says, my favorite coffee is Colombian beans that I roast at home using a 1970s era hot air popcorn popper. Unfortunately, we can only do it outside because the process produces a lot of smoke. It also has to be warm or the popper roaster won't get hot enough. We roast it quite dark and then use it for espresso and a French press. And somebody writing in as Roaster X says, these are things I hear people talking about in the coffee house. How can I tell the difference between good coffee and bad coffee? What is meant by the term specialty coffee? How can I tell if my coffee is stale? And how do people become professional coffee tasters? What is relationship coffee? What is direct trade? A lot of questions there apparently being asked at the coffee houses, but I want to pick up on this one of the difference between good coffee and bad coffee. Dan, how does someone differentiate and what makes a good cup of coffee?
We start with the cup of coffee is 98.5% water. So if, like Kevin mentioned earlier, if you don't have good water, and good water needs to be sound, which means it has to have a certain percentage of minerals in it. It must be neutral in its flavor, a pH of around 7, must not have any off odors in it. No chloramines, et cetera. So it starts with the water. After that, the next best thing is the species of coffee, because there's about 30 species of coffee, but there are two commercially grown. One is Arabica and the other is Robusta. All the attention is in the Arabica species today because there are more diverse and gentle flavors and nuances. The next thing would be to buy fresh coffee. And this is a bone of contention because fresh coffee, the packaging guys will tell you if you have vacuum packaging, coffee can stay fresh for a year. Technically, that's true, but the reality is fresh roasted coffee is meant to be consumed usually within 10 days, 10 days or 2 weeks. So we recommend only buying enough that's going to last 10 days to 2 weeks. Then the method of brewing, grinding, how you grind coffee is incredibly important. So getting the grind particle size to the right dimensions are very important. There's a proliferation of inexpensive grinders that don't work very well. You don't have to spend hundreds, but you probably do have to spend $800. And then it's measuring.
Why can't I just use my, you know, $30 grinder and get it to kind of where I want it to, and, you know, grind it a little longer if I want it a little finer? What's the big deal about a good grinder?
Because what the grind does, you're taking a solid and you're eventually going to make it into a liquid. And the process is called extraction. And how you extract it is how you break the beans apart to all these little fine particles. And you want as much universal particle size as possible. So when the hot water goes over the grounds, you want to extract as much as you as much of the good components out of it. And you actually want to leave some of the other components in it. So if you grind it too fine, there's a very good chance you've burned the coffee during the process of grinding through friction, and number two, you probably could over extract it. Then the process of how do you make the coffee, there's at least 7 or 8 different ways of making coffee. The Chemex method is still a wonderful method. The French press or Meliere method is a wonderful method. A pour over is great. You mentioned AeroPress. That works really good. Espresso is a whole nother animal. I stay away from that myself.
You mean for a home?
For home, I mean, you can get away with it, but the reality is espresso without a crema, espresso is a facsimile.
And the crema is that sort of light brown, almost cream-looking stuff.
Yes.
At the top of
it's a layer of kind of foamy crusty that is the fats and carbohydrates that are coming to the surface of the coffee. And right under that is a layer of aromas that are really important. So measuring the coffee, brewing it in the right amount of time, not over-brewing it. Percolators in the old days smelled great, tasted terrible, the coffee coming out of it because they made it too hot and they recycled it. And then consuming it at the right temperature. There's all sorts of controversy over the temperature of the coffee being consumed, but better to be a little too hot than too cold. You can always let the coffee cool. Obviously, if you're going to put condiments in it, making sure you use good condiments, not facsimile condiments. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes in, but I think the number one thing is the difference between good coffee and bad coffee is, number one, starts with the nose. The nose knows. If it's got a great fragrance, it's probably good things that have come. If there's very little fragrance, that's a good sign of coffee that's probably stale. It's old because it's not degassing, not giving you those fragrances. So that's first. I tell your caller that the first thing is smell the coffee. Does it have a lot of good coffee smell? If there's any off odors in it, that's a good sign. You may want to stay away from it too. So fragrance is everything. It starts with the fragrance, and then it goes to what's supposed to be in the coffee. Is it supposed to be smooth, mellow, slight acidity, good body? What's not supposed to be in there? Is it dirty, rubbery, grassy, earthy, et cetera, et cetera? So we start by saying, is coffee sound? And the term sound means without faults or taints. After that, there's no end to how wonderful it can be, but it has to start with its sound. There's nothing wrong with the coffee.
We got a note from Seth, the grocery manager at the food co-op in Springfield, who says, as a coffee person from an early age, I've come to appreciate coffee in a whole new way since I started my current job 5 years ago. Meeting and doing business with Vermont coffee roasters has been a real pleasure. From bigger names like Mocha Joe's down to the very small operations like Abracadabra Coffee in Cavendish, every roaster brings their own flavors to the table. Also, a little shout out to all the wonderful co-ops throughout the state that sell the freshest and locally roasted coffee we can. And Steve says, every morning I make a cafe latte for myself to savor with some treat. But in my 5 decades of coffee worship, the best coffee experience is the good cup that is handed to me by a friend with a moment of eye contact. For the transaction of the circumstance is what makes the coffee experience the most holy and profound. It was my brother who first handed me my first cafe latte within an hour of arriving in Oakland, California in 1984. And that moment, I knew that the visit was worth the effort to get there all the way from Vermont. The best part was that he then showed me how to make my own latte, and I've been making them ever since, as well as handing them to anyone who visits me. And as we talk about culture here and community, let's turn to Paul Ralston, founder and president of Vermont Coffee Company, who's on the line with us from Middlebury. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Jane. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. It's nice to have you with us.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, Dan. Jane, you got to know that Dan Cox is my coffee mentor.
Oh, good.
We've known each other for 40 years, and he is the guy who unselfishly promoted the coffee industry in Vermont, and there's many, many businesses. Most of the people you're talking to and hearing from have had some connection back to Dan Cox. He is the guy.
Paul, I'm drinking a cup of your coffee right now.
Okay.
I'm not just saying that. I really am.
So, Jane, the one thing, listening to the show so far, the one thing I just want to talk about a little bit is that there is a lot of dogma in coffee. Coffee is one of those things that It's in a way like wine, where you know people get really geeky and really nerdy about it, and they put a lot of rules and lots of structure around something that can just be a free flow experience. I mean, for me, the answer to an earlier question about how do you tell good coffee is does it taste good?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, people have different tastes, and that's one of the things that makes life interesting. And you need to find what works for you. You need to find what coffee to use, how to grind it, how to brew it. And you need to experiment. You need to just, you know, be free with it and lighten up and don't worry. It'll all work out.
You know, Paul, I was just reading an email about this idea of community and culture, and you've sort of taken that a step further at Vermont Coffee Company, and you've actually developed a community space right in your headquarters. Can you tell us about it?
Well, we actually have two community spaces because we have a cafe that we opened a little more than a year ago. The thing about coffee is, coffee is a social stimulant. It is an experience and a product that brings people together and has always brought people together. Historically, coffee houses were the places where people gathered to make revolutions and to make business. And we have, at our place in Middlebury, we have a sweet little cafe where people can come in, and if you want to learn how to make coffee or you want to experiment, we can teach you there. But we also have another community space that we opened last fall, which is a little theater, a little playhouse. And it's a place where folks in the community can come and perform, and where folks in the community can come and experience. And we've just kind of started it up, but most of the things that we're doing include time in the cafe around coffee and time in the theater around art. And those two just really flow well together.
It's exciting to hear about. And Paul Ralston, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, founder and president of the Vermont Coffee Company in Middlebury. Paul, thanks.
You're welcome.
Talking about coffee today, we have Dan Cox with us, owner and president of Coffee Enterprises. And let's go to Margot calling in from Wethersfield. Hi, Margot.
Yes, many of us out here love coffee, and we like it after dinner. Does anybody make really good decaffeinated coffee?
Yeah, okay, Margot, I hear you on this. Dan Cox, what about decaf? For people who are not looking for the up in the cup but like coffee, is there good decaf?
There is. The decaf market has been stable for the last 40 years at about 10% of coffee consumers. I look at decaf coffees as the golden goose because they don't want to get out of the category, but it's kind of like getting a gin and tonic without the gin.
We should say, I mean, there's this whole mocktails market now. It's big at these big bars.
I love decaf coffee drinkers. There is good decaf coffee. You just have to search it out.
Mm-hmm.
And most good small coffee roasters now will get one or two decafs. And it's still a wonderful product. So thank you for staying in the category.
We got a note from Christina who says, I'm wondering where people who are passionate about coffee but don't know too much about the roasting and brewing process and coffee culture can go to learn more.
Well, you can join the Specialty Coffee Association of America, where they have a lot of classes. You can certainly, most coffee roasters have classes now, and you can go online and learn a lot. Unfortunately, online there is a lot of fake news. So
yep.
We have to be careful of what you read. Just because you read about it online doesn't mean it's necessarily true. But do start with Googling, find out locally. There are places available.
And Christina, I would say, you know, I don't know that much either, but I'm interested. And every time I go to a really nice cafe and ask the baristas about the coffee that they're actually brewing, they are a wealth of information and have always seemed very happy to share it with me. So I encourage you to go to a coffee shop and just ask, too. Dan Cox is owner and president of Coffee Enterprises, based in Hinesburg. Dan, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I got to do one last shout-out, please, and that's for my favorite organization called Grounds for Health, which is doing cervical cancer screening for women in coffee-producing countries. And it's a wonderful organization. But more importantly, thanks for being a coffee drinker, Jane. Thanks for your having studio of having me in. It's wonderful. Come by our offices. I think you'll find it's a pretty cool place to hang out.
Oh, I'd love to. Dan Cox, thanks. Coming up, veteran Vermont journalist Candace Page was just inducted into the New England Newspaper Hall of Fame. We'll look back at the highlights of her career with Candy herself next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. She has a ferocious work ethic, and she's an inspiration to fresh and seasoned journalists alike. That's what the New England Newspaper and Press Association says about reporter Candace Page, who was inducted into the New England Newspaper Hall of Fame last week. Candy spent 30-plus years at the Burlington Free Press. Since leaving the Freeps, she's worked as a reporter and editor at 7 Days. Even in retirement, she's not out of commission, except when she's getting quality time with her family in Portland, Oregon. And Candy Page, you join us now from a studio in Portland. It's nice to talk with you.
It's great to be here, Jane. I'm in the one place that's cloudier and rainier than Burlington, Vermont.
And congratulations. This is a really big achievement. What does it feel like to you to be inducted into the New England Newspaper Hall of Fame?
Oh, it's very embarrassing in a way because I feel as if the people who nominated me, all of them, are much better journalists than I was. What I have over them, I think, is I'm older.
Come on. See, you're too modest, Candy. I mean, we're going to talk about some of the highlights of your career, but, you know, 30-plus years in journalism in Vermont and really covering the waterfront of issues. You've covered politics, you've covered food, you've covered science and the environment. I mean, that is quite a career. You've seen a lot of Vermont and you have introduced and helped educate people on a variety of topics over your career. So it must feel gratifying to be recognized.
Yes, it is very nice for someone who spent most of her career at a 50,000 circulation newspaper to be recognized by the journalism community and by people I really respect. But I have been incredibly lucky in my life. I grew up in Vermont. I went away, worked elsewhere. But when I got married and was ready to start a family, I came back to Vermont. And once you do that, you have put a ceiling in a way, on your ambitions. And I have to say, for all its flaws, the Burlington Free Press treated me very well. I did everything from clean the refrigerator to act as managing editor in my 30 years there. And anytime I got bored, they let me do something else. So I feel very fortunate to have written all my life, written news that my friends and neighbors and family and the community that means so much to me gets to read what I write.
We're going to do the Vermont Edition version of Candy Page, This Is Your Life, except I promise we won't bring any random people who you're not expecting into this interview. But I would love to take you back.
Good.
And have you describe the first newsroom you worked in, you know, the people, the technology, what it was you were doing.
Well, this is really going to date me because the first newsroom I ever worked in was my parents' weekly newspaper, the Suburban List, in Essex Junction. And my first job there, as I was probably 12, was proofreading, which involved hot lead type that had been set in a huge machine and was laid out in banks. And because it was the reverse of what you would see in the newspaper, you had to be able to read upside down and backwards. But, you know, in the time that I worked as a reporter, almost everything changed about journalism. The speed at which we communicated changed dramatically. You know, when I started at the Free Press, if the governor said something at 9 o'clock in the morning, it would still be news, brand new to most of our readers when they picked up their newspaper at 6 o'clock the next morning. Now that's inconceivable. One of the things that I think is a huge change that we don't think about often enough was the proliferation of sources of news. And of course, in many ways, it's wonderful to have so many voices, so many places to find out what's going on. On the other hand, what we've given up is a common base of knowledge of our communities. I think when I started at the Free Press, the penetration of the paper, that is, the percentage of the population that got the Free Press and read the Free Press, was higher than 100%. Because some people got it at home and they got it at the office. So when the Burlington City Council did something, when the Jericho Select Board did something, everybody had that information. And I think that that is good for democracy. If you know what's going on in your community and that comes to your doorstep every morning, it's very easy, much easier for you to get angry and get involved. To me, when we look at journalism in the context of the community and society, that's one of the biggest changes I've seen.
Candy, the flip side, though, to that benefit, which I agree with you on, is that, you know, if you have more sources, you have perhaps more diversity of opinion and analysis. And certainly right now we're seeing that that can be overwhelming, and it can be hard to differentiate what's an accurate source from propaganda, you know, what's fact, what's opinion. But you also still have the ability to have people reporting on things that might not get covered by a monolithic newspaper. Do you see, I mean, how do you, from your perspective, coming from this world where there was that density of one source to the new era, how do you balance that and see that balance?
Jane, I think it's absolutely critical to have as many organizations covering the news as possible. And I think we've seen how important that is. As the circulation of newspapers in Vermont has plummeted, newspapers like the Free Press and really every newspaper have had to reduce the number of reporters they have on staff. Where would we be now if we didn't have Vermont Digger and all the digging it did on the EB5 scandal? What would we do without 7 Days, you know, possibly one of the strongest alternative newspapers in the country? What would I do without the various blog posts that I read about what's going on in Vermont government? I think that's incredibly important. And I guess the answer is that the world changes, and it's good that for the loss that we've had of that commonality, we have had the benefit of the diversity of voices.
You have also had a diversity of beats. You've, as I said, covered politics, food, the environment, other things. Is there a consistency, though, in your style or approach?
I've always thought that what I wanted most as a reporter was for readers to read the first 4 or 5 paragraphs of my story on the front page and be willing to turn the page and keep reading. It's so easy to lose readers when that's required. So I think what I can say about my style that has been consistent is I've always tried to make my stories as lively as possible so that people would get to the jump and automatically turn the page to find out what was in the next paragraph. And I think the way I did it is by telling stories about people's lives, about featuring characters that can bring an issue alive. I once wrote the obituary of a black racer snake. And I wrote it the way you would write an obituary that appears on the obituary page. And it allowed me to communicate to readers in a way that I think was highly readable. I hope it was, that these snakes are seriously endangered in Vermont, and losing this one snake was a threat to its whole species. The first political campaign I ever covered, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. And Peanut Kennedy, who was a Republican candidate for governor, invited me to ride along with him on a campaign day. So I sat in the back seat and listened to him argue with his wife. And I got to write a story that started with this squabble that was revealing of his personality and the security of his marriage, of course, but that I think and hope turned him into a person people would want to turn the page to learn more about.
Is there a story that you still want to take a crack at?
Well, I think possibly the most interesting story I ever reported and wrote never saw the light of day. And if I could go back to it, I think I would. In about 1974, 75, I spent 3 days riding around the Northeast Kingdom with an anti-poverty worker. And I saw people's lives and the poverty of people's lives that, as someone who lived in Chittenden County, I had no concept of. I will never forget the 80-year-old blind woman who lived alone in one room of a big house with only her radio for company and an outhouse in the backyard. You know, that's not the kind of thing that we think happens in Vermont. And if I could go back to seeing those invisible lives and writing about them, that would be very satisfying.
Why didn't that story see the light of day when you reported it?
Well, I was a brand new reporter, very naive. Brian Vachon was the brand new editor of Vermont Life at the time, and he was also very naive about Vermont Life. He commissioned the story, and I wrote the story, and he loved the story. And then he discovered that the poverty of rural Vermont was not actually part of the mission of Vermont Life. So I got a kill fee, and the story is still in my files.
I hope you'll let me read it sometime.
Well, I'd love to. Thank you.
Candy, it's a pleasure to talk with you. This is a well-deserved accolade. Congratulations, and good luck in the rest of your career, which, you know, is not over.
Well, thanks so much, Jane. One of the things I miss about being a reporter is coming to VPR and talking with you about the natural world and the wonders of it.
Well, you've been an inspiration to me, so I really appreciate it, Candy.
Thank you, Jane.
Candice Page is an editor at 7 Days and was just inducted into the New England Newspaper Hall of Fame. Governor Phil Scott is our guest on the next show. The state budget is a contentious issue between the governor and the Democratic leadership in the legislature. That'll be one of the topics we'll discuss tomorrow on Vermont Edition. And you can send your questions for Governor Scott to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.